what, since the second half, really, how much they've really struggled.
Mind set.
Charged with finding some stability from this scrum, and he can't find it. That's a mighty shot. A mighty one. Leicester.
The scrum battle resumes now. And a big shot from Brazil. Oh, that's sensational.
Here comes the big Georgian scrum. They're absolutely demolished. The Fiji in front of.
Man, the challenge, definitely the challenge is observing what's happening and identifying that, hey, if someone's struggling, what can we do? You know, so it'll be reframing that particular activity for them to ensure that they're motivated through being able to actually succeed at something. And then for the guys that are, you know, getting a little bit disengaged because they're too good for the activity, we reframe that with some different challenges. And then I guess the overarching thing around the environment is there needs to be failure and lots of it. So that way, the guy who can't pass to the right, he doesn't actually feel bad about that because there's quite a bit of failure taking place. Now, so if everybody's executing every skill and he can't pass to the right, then he's going to feel shit about himself, or she's going to feel shit about herself. So that's just a couple of little, I guess, tools around that.
Yeah, nice. Welcome back to the next episode of The Journey of a Grassroots Rugby Coach. And today, my guest is Mike Rogers. Mike is currently the assistant coach at the New England Free Jacks in the MLR. In the United States, and is also the founder of the Inside Running Academy in New Zealand. Mike also hosts the Coach Learning Series, which is where we first connected, and we've had a few chats over the years about different coaching as we move through our journey. Mike talks about learning from failure and allowing players to fail during training to help improve them as players. We spoke about being involved in drills during training, so that you can provide immediate feedback when necessary. We also talked about how to have those difficult conversations with players and how to give difficult types of feedback and some methods that he's tried and some methods that he's going to try in the future. He gave some tips around coaching defense and helping your players read pitches in the defense. We also chatted about whether we're getting the best benefit from our pre-game warm-up. If you're anything like me, every time you speak to Mike, you walk away having to reflect on a lot of things and a lot of your thinking. I could have spoken to Mike for hours around rugby stuff, his coach education stuff, and all the stuff that he's doing. Feel free to contact Mike at Inside Running Academy. All the links will be in the show notes. Again, thanks for listening. Feel free to give us a thumbs up. Give the episode a rating. Pass this on to anybody that you feel can benefit from it. Thank you so much for your support. Sit back and enjoy this chat with Mike Rogers. This episode of The Journey of a Grassroots Rugby Coach is brought to you by Bull & Bear Crew. Bull & Bear Crew is a range of men's skincare products. There is face moisturizers, face mist, body wash, beard wash, shave oil, and moisturizer. They come in a 100ml pack. Aluminium bottles, so they're safe for traveling. You can use them check-in your baggage. They also come in larger at-home bottles. All bottles are refillable, reusable, and recyclable. You can buy refill pouches to refill bottles you have at home if you don't want to purchase bottles from Bull & Bear Crew. They've just been released. Great product, all natural, or vegan. Tested on men, not on animals, all that good stuff. Recyclable, reusable, and refillable. So you can use them over and over and over again. Go to their website, check them out, www.bullandbearcrew.com. Place your order. At the moment, they're only shipping within Australia, but keep your ears and your eyes out to the website. They may be able to extend the shipping at some point in the future. Please enjoy this episode. All right, let's make a start, Mike. So welcome, Mike. Just for the listeners that might not know who you are, first of all, who are you, where are you, and what's your involvement with the grassroots game? And we'll talk deeply more about some of the other stuff that you're involved in as well as we go through.
G'day, Bully. Thanks very much for having me on, mate. Like I said to you when we were offline then, I really enjoy doing things like this for two reasons. One, I always learn something. And secondly, they still actually scare me. So I think that's a good reason to do stuff, eh? So my name is Mike Rogers. I'm a professional rugby coach. Currently coaching the New England Free Jacks in the MLR and based in Boston, which is a pretty cool place. I guess my connection to community rugby is I was only ever a club player, wasn't a world beater, never played the game professionally. Then started coaching club rugby in 2010, coached my local club team for 6 years, then went on to coach Papunis under 19 side, and then from that transitioned into professional coaching with the NPC team, and did a couple of other bits and pieces between times, and now I'm coaching over in the States. So it's a little bit of a different journey than most days. So what we're seeing, I guess, in the game now is the vast majority of coaches, and it's probably always been this way, but I think it's probably a little bit more visible now, is the vast majority have played the game professionally and transitioned pretty quickly into professional coaching. And I think that's fine. I reckon there's definitely a place for that, but I think there's still a place for people coming through our community game. And I'm really passionate about helping those people. So I do a couple little things in that space, which are pretty awesome as well, because I know that she's a lonely old place when you've got some ambition and drive to kind of push yourself in terms of your coaching and kind of feel like you're not getting a lot of reward a lot of the time. So, mate, that's me in a nutshell. Three kids, they're living here in Mount Maunganui. They spend the time that I'm in Boston with my ex-wife, their mum, and that's really cool that she supports me with that. And they spend a period of time up there with me. And then when I'm here in New Zealand, I live in Mount Maunganui and I have the kids 1 week on, 1 week off. So they've just gone back to their mums tonight, and we've had an awesome last week, actually, running a camp here at the moment for 14 to 18-year-old rugby players. So my 10-year-old's been out there, Frankie, running around playing games and stuff with them. And what a pretty cool experience for your kids to be able to do stuff like that. So. Yeah, mate, that's me. I think that's about us then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Job
done. See you later. No, thanks, Mike. And we'll talk about the Inside Running Academy as we go through. And you mentioned there the stuff that you try and help the grassroots coaches out with. And that's where we met, through some of those online things that you ran that were just awesome. And there were some good connections come out of that. So what got you into coaching in the first place? Having not been, like you said, you haven't been a professional player, you didn't play at that level. What made you transition into the coaching pathway?
It's just by chance, really. So I finished playing, I turned 30 and makes me feel really old, in 2009, and that was the last year that I played. So I said I was going to play until I was 30. It was a funny season where I got injured and I managed to get back for the end of the season, and we won a championship, which was cool, and I was like, oh, that's fitting. Like, so I was pretty happy to hang up the boots, and the club kind of went through a search to find a new coach. So the coach that we'd had for a couple of years, he'd decided to move on, and they found a guy called Ryan Dunnett, who's actually become a really good long-term friend now. And he reached out to me after kind of getting his feet on the ground here and said, hey, would you mind coming along and giving us a hand, or at least for pre-season until we can find somebody? So I was like, oh yeah, mate, I'll come and give you a hand. That's cool. And kind of just fell into it. And I thought definitely over the first 2 or 3 years of coaching that I knew everything. I thought I was really good. One thing I was really good at was recruitment, but I wasn't really good at anything else. And, I had an absolute catastrophe in 2012, which, I say that this is still probably the greatest learning for me is, you know, we had a $1 million team basically in 2012 with my club team, Tauranga Sports, and we had a whole bunch of dudes of players who are playing Super Rugby. We played against a club team called Otoiti 2 weeks before the semi-finals. We beat them 78-3, and then we played them again in the semi-final and they beat us 13-12. And that was the start of a long process around, one, figuring out what happened. Then after going through that process, figuring out that the players didn't really like me, they didn't really like each other. There was no culture. The whole team was built on star players. And when we got put under pressure for the first time in the entire season, just about, we capitulated. And that was really hard to have to look in the mirror and go, man, I actually created this. It's not really consistent with who I am as a person, but you just become hell-bent on winning. And like I'm definitely competitive, but there was no care basically that was just totally missing from the whole thing. And yeah, I guess that was the start really. So probably up until that point I was coaching because it satisfied my ego. And then after that I started coaching because I had a real thirst and real curiosity around the game and trying to figure out, man, how do we put a group of people together and make it function? And there's lots of skill involved in that, which is cool because it's a forever thing, eh? So
yeah,
yeah, so I think I'm the type of person that I learn a lot more from my failures than my successes anyway. And I'm fortunate enough to have quite a few big ones like that. And they've always set me right on the right path. And I guess the learning is, as coaches is actually identifying when they happen and actually be prepared to look into the mirror and take a fair bit of responsibility, which was very, very difficult pill to swallow, like no doubt about it. But mate, it's all part of it. It's the thing that makes it cool, I guess.
And that's a good point, mate. And that sort of led into that next bit where we're going to get to heartbreaks and disappointments that we learn from. Because, you know, when we're young coaches and inexperienced coaches and we have those setbacks like you were talking about, a lot of guys just go, oh, that's it, I'm not cut out for this. And they throw their toys out of the cot and they walk away. And like you said, anyone that's coached for any more than probably two seasons has had something that they can relate to what you've just said and gone, yep, I've done this. That was crap. But then, you know, what do I look at? How do I reflect on that? How do we get better? What do we need to do? Yeah, so that's really good, mate. That any good coach has had those disappointments, and it's how we bounce back from them and potentially change what we do or rethink what we do, and just makes us better, I think. Which as young coaches, we tend not to. We just go, oh, that was pretty crap. I'm a shit coach, blah, blah, blah. So.
And you definitely have to have a thick skin, but I actually thank those people because we went through that process, had a really awesome season the following year, really connected group, managed to win the championship the following year, which was cool. Virtually the same player group. There wasn't a lot of change to it. It was just showed it was so much fun. And then in 2014, we had a whole bunch of guys who retired. And then 2014, we had a really young team. And that was the next real learning for me is I just thought, hey, we had all these guys that had been in and around our environment and we could just throw them all out there at once. People talk about a rebuild. And we struggled early on in the season. And the reason for that is those players weren't ready yet. Like we just assumed that they were and they weren't. And there was just too many young guys and not enough experience. And so that was really tough on those players and we were almost setting them up to fail. And, you know, there's a team that had, you know, made top four every year for like 10 plus years. And I think we had 5 or 6 weeks to go before the semis and you know, we were under the pump. It was looking like we weren't going to make the top four and we changed the way that we played. A couple of experienced guys came back and helped out, which was really good. And we went on a run and then we lost the semi-final. And I was pretty gutted, but we actually played quite well in the semi-final and the team had beat us. Outplayed us, so that's cool. And I was actually really proud of the team because I think we had to win 5 or 6 in a row just to make it through to the top four. And I was at a kid's birthday party on the Sunday, probably a little bit dusty to be fair. And one of the older guys at the club came up to me and he said, oh, how are you feeling after yesterday? And I said, oh, man, I'm really gutted for the boys because, yeah, they turned things around and it was, you know, we were really competitive. We lost by 4 points or something. And he's like, oh, well, I guess it's time to give someone else a go. You're obviously past it. And so I made a conscious choice that day that I was going to coach the team again the following year. And I was probably on the fence up until that point. And that was just that moment, you know, and I guess that's that competitive edge in me coming out to go, man, I'm not having this person here who knows nothing about what we've been trying to do tell me to give it up and give someone else a go because I felt that there was something there. And the following season was the best, probably the best. She would be up there in terms of the most enjoyable season that I had and the best group of people because we had all these young guys that were then another year older and we had a fantastic season and beat a really good team, probably the best team that we'd come up against in the 6 years that I coached club rugby. And a great final, we won it was just an awesome season. Two teams that were head-to-head battle all year and we got to the final, played them at their place and it was a great game and we won a close game. And I kind of felt sorry for the opposition because they'd had an awesome season. But that's just that whole thing is But there's going to be a lot of people tell you you're wasting your time. You know, you're never going to make it to be a professional. Well, who says that that's the measure of success? I don't think it is. People are always going to think that somebody else can do better. But you just got to back yourself, man. Like, and it is really, really hard because you start doubting yourself. Am I the right person to lead this group? But I kind of always looked at it as, we've got to build a team around us in terms of players. We've got to build a team around us in terms of people that support. So there's some really good things going into that 2015 year. I managed to get a mate of mine who actually played against us in the 2012 team that lost that game. I played rugby with him at high school and I phoned him up and he said, what do you want? And I said, I want you to come over and help me coach Tauranga Sports next year. And he goes, you know that my people won't, you would, that would never happen. My people won't accept that. And I was like, oh, well, we're going to have a beer and have a talk about this at some point. And his name's Wayne Norman, but Bay of Plenty legend, and managed to convince him to come over and coach with us for a year. And then he actually went and coached a bit of professional rugby after that. And that's what, that was part of it, you know, as I was like, man, we just need to tweak our little environment here and maybe have a little bit more edge. And like, I wasn't the person for that. So I had to find somebody that could deliver on that. So, mate, it's a long-winded story, but I guess the key thing is just perseverance and finding people to help us, you know, like we can't do it all on our own.
And there's a couple of good points there that I like. And like you said, that old boy from the club, you know, said, made that comment to you. And we find that at Clubland, because you've got your old boys there and potentially their sons play and they've always got to have a say. And we say to our players, what those people on the sideline think doesn't matter. They don't know what we're doing. They don't know our game plan. They don't know what your role is. They, you know, like, and sometimes they get caught in that blur of, well, my dad's telling me I've got to do this, or uncle's saying I've got to do this. And that can be frustrating for players and coaches. But yeah, just trying to manage that. And the second bit is the bit where you said, you know, you get someone else to come and do what you're not good at, or that can improve what you do. You know, as young coaches, it was always like, yeah, I was like, you knew everything, blah, blah, blah. And then the more you do it, you go, oh shit, I don't really know that much at all when it comes to this, this, and this, you know. So bring someone in that can help you benefit your players. So some good points there, mate.
Yeah, and I think around that second point in particular, that demonstrates to your players that you're actually identified that it's about them. You know, ultimately, it's their team. They're the ones who played the game. We're just there supporting them, really. Yeah. So, but that's a critical message that I think gets lost. And so, for me, it's always been about, hey, let's have the best possible people being able to support them. And with that, you know, probably comes a little bit of expectation, I guess is the right word for it, of them to be able to then go, oh man, if these guys are investing this much in us, we should probably behave this way, which they generally figure out and they do. Versus, oh no, I can do it all on my own, and you're running around and it's just a bit of a nightmare, and the players probably feel sorry for you, but they probably don't feel like they're getting any better. And ultimately, that's what they want. They want to be connected to other humans and they want to be getting better at something. But that's what we're, and that's across all levels, whether you're coaching the All Blacks or coaching Tauranga Sports under 13s. Kids just want to get better. They'll have a lot of fun in getting better, and they want to be connected to their mates, and there's fun involved in that for them as well, you know? So,
yeah.
And that's what we should always kind of be checking ourselves on that stuff.
Yeah. And I think, too, the point there is, if you're investing in yourself as a coach, and I've got some of my players that just say to me, oh, so what are you working on now, Bully? Like, because rugby's not on, what are we thinking? What are you thinking about? And then I have those conversations with them. I'm thinking about, what if we do this next year? And then all of a sudden we're creating a bit of a snowball as well, because then the players are buying into what we're doing. And, you know, and some of those sessions we did with you, I go back to the boys and go, I was talking to these guys about this the other day, and they're going, oh yeah, cool. Let's, you know, yes, it's going to work for us, or no, it's not. Or, you know, and then all of a sudden they've got that, shit, these guys are actually out trying to make us better. So they feel like they're getting appreciated for the effort that, like you said, they're there on a Tuesday, Thursday night, been on the tools all day, might have a shitty job and a shitty boss, and they just want to get out and have some fun. And you've shown to them that you care about them because you're investing and you're trying to better yourself to make them better.
Yeah, I think as long as we see it as a partnership, I think it's a word that we have to use a lot more. Like, it's a partnership. So you know, I'm trying to help the players. We create a partnership that way, but they can also help me with some stuff. We can explore some stuff together. There might be some non-negotiables there somewhere, especially around standards, but generally they know what they figure out what those are pretty quickly anyway. And a lot of that stuff's, you know, self-regulated. So, but I think, man, if we can just be talking about, hey, we're in a partnership here, what do you think? This is, do I have permission to give you some feedback? You know, and then, hey, man, how about we work on some of this stuff together? Like, that sounds a lot better than, oh, I think you need to work on this, go away and work on it, and you're not going to be in the team until you've got better. But that's kind of how I see it anyway.
Yeah, and, mate, to be honest, most of the players know what they need to work on. You know, so if you say, you know, Mike, what do you think you need to work on? Oh, I think I need to work on my left-right pass and on my left shoulder's weak in defence. Okay, cool, let's work on those first. And then you can add, you can layer stuff in as well. So getting to know your players and letting them know that you care about them and you want to get them better. So, no, that's really good, man. How do you keep, especially like with the academy stuff that you run, when you have a heap of kids there, different levels, some kids have maybe never played the game before or not haven't played a lot. You've got, you know, potentially an athlete that's going to hit a good pathway and take off, because we can all pick those players. How do we keep those two players engaged in a session so that we develop the potential, you know, elite player while keeping the guy involved that might be there because his mates are playing? You know, he's never going to be a first 15 player, but in 20 years, he's probably going to be the major sponsor of the club or the guy around the club that does everything. He's just a good rugby person. But you've got to keep them both engaged and involved and develop both of them at different levels.
It's certainly an art. But I actually think it's an art in terms of it's an everything. It's, how do I put this? It's an art in terms of we have to be observing and looking for and noticing the whole time, right?
Yeah.
And so it's all a principle of appropriate challenge. So the best player in your team needs to be challenged in different ways to the person who's just learning the game.
Yep.
The guy who's just learning the game, we need to drive his belief system by getting him to identify with a couple of things that he can do. And we help the strengths-based coaching for him around, here's a couple of things that you can do. And let's just really focus on that, man. So we might be playing a game and there's one or two of the skills that he's good at within the game. And then there just becomes a little bit of specialization happening in there that, you know, yeah, that's awesome when you work really hard to get back when there's been a line break. And that's an effort thing. It's something that he can do. Cool. So we start making sure we reward that behavior, because then with a pat on the back or a little look or whatever it is to get them to continue being engaged around it, man, I'm contributing. But for the player, the two or three players who are, you know, streets ahead of everybody else, we need to challenge them. So that might be, okay, in order to score a try, there's got to be a kick in there. Yeah, cool. So they're like, okay, well, how the hell are we going to do that? So just manipulating things for them to ensure that they're still going, oh shit, okay, how's this going to work? Or it might be, hey man, you can't make a line break, but you can set other people up for line breaks. So now there's a new challenge for them. How am I going to do that? How do I figure that out? They'll probably get frustrated to begin with. And giving them leadership responsibility, but actually teaching them around leadership. So rather than being instructional, they're asking questions and trying to do that through a discovery or exploration type thing. Like, that's all little challenges that we can be setting them within sessions that are going to keep them engaged. It's going to be challenging in different ways than what they used to. And we just sell the dream that, hey man, wherever you're going in terms of your rugby career, you're going to need more skills than what you have right now. And these are some things that you can be working on in our environment that are going to help you wherever you end up next. And then for the guys that are pretty new to it, it's really about, hey man, what can you do? Like, what are you good at? Okay, you're good at working hard. Cool. We can really work with that, because when this type of thing happens in a training or a game that we're playing, that's something you can do and you can be a really big contributor. And then obviously their skill set just grows by doing. And then we can start going, okay, well, you're actually really good at taking the ball into contact. So let's get you working on your footwork on that, so you can start seeing space between defenders and start scaffolding that skill for them so they get more confident with it. And then I guess everybody in between. But man, the challenge is observing what's happening and identifying that, hey, if someone's struggling, what can we do? you know, so it'll be reframing that particular activity for them to ensure that they're motivated through being able to actually succeed at something. And then for the guys that are, you know, getting a little bit disengaged because they're too good for the activity, we reframe that with some different challenges. And then I guess the overarching thing around the environment is there needs to be failure and lots of it. So that way the guy who can't pass to the right, he doesn't actually feel bad about that because there's quite a bit of failure taking place. Now, so if everybody's executing every skill and he can't pass to the right, then he's going to feel shit about himself or she's going to feel shit about herself. So that's just a couple of little, I guess, tools around that.
Yeah, nice.
But the key thing is, I reckon, working in a co-coaching group so people are noticing this stuff because you can't see it all yourself, especially if you're in there delivering an activity. You'll only see what happens within kind of a 5 meter bubble of yourself. So having those people observing, they can even be the people who are setting challenges for people as it's all happening, because they'll be seeing stuff. Eh? So trying to make that whole process as dynamic as we possibly can.
Yeah, no, that's good, mate. I like that. Some good tips there. So if you were running in a co-coaching setup, would you have, so if you're running the activity and you've got, say, two other coaches with you, would you allocate them or would you give them, they just wander between the players, or does that depend on what the activity is that you're doing?
Yeah, so the model that I work with Scott Matthew, who's the head coach at the Free Jacks, is on a Tuesday's attack day, so he leads the 15 on 15 session, which is makes up the majority of what we do in terms of training. And I appreciate that a lot of club teams don't have that luxury, but if you can find a way of making that happen, that'll transform your game. So he'll lead that, which means that he virtually referees it, and he sets up what the, you know, what the places on the field are that we're attacking from. Are we starting from a transition, a line out of scrum? It's all pretty fluid and dynamic, and you know, there's pretty high ball and play time. So he'll be on the attacking side of the coin, I guess that's how you'd look at it. And that's a pretty pretty narrow lens. So he'll be right in amongst it. From a defensive perspective, I'll be right in amongst it as well. And I've kind of changed that because I've found that it's more valuable for me to hear conversations taking place between players, to start seeing pictures that they see. And I've got a better reference point because if someone's continually not getting off the line quickly, I need to understand why. So were they slow to fold? Were they slow to get into the line? Were they not watching the ball when the, you know, when we're needing to generate line speed? Like, what's the issue? And I can't see that from 30, 40 metres away, and it's too late by the time I review the training footage. So I've got to be in there. So we're both in there. One person's looking after attack, the other one's looking after D, and one of us is refereeing it. Then the luxury is when you've got a bigger coaching group, you can get people looking at other things. And so it might be we're getting out, like there's heaps of things that we do around this, but one of them might be we're looking for a kick space. And so I can't see that when I'm right in the middle of it, and neither can Scott. So third coach might be looking at kick space in the backfield, what kick options are on, and then he'll be having conversations with the drivers, the 9, 10, 15 around, hey, this is what they're doing in the backfield and this is where the kick space is. So then they can modify what we're doing around that. They start looking for that a little bit more, and then there's a learning opportunity there. It could be detail around, you know, ball into contact, or pass quality is another really good one to start looking out for, like what's the pass quality like when we're under pressure. But actually giving those other people those designated roles enables them, so they can either communicate to us because we've got comms on, they can communicate to us to deliver a message to someone, or they might just run onto the field and say, hey man, remember, hey, that's really awesome, you've done you've been struggling to your right, you've done three perfect passes to your right, that's cool. Or it might be, hey, remember when you're on the run, we need you to keep your hips square. Don't worry too much about the pass quality. Let's just make sure that we're square. You know, there could be anything going on there. But that stuff's all obviously aligned to their personal, like their individual development plans. But that's kind of where we're heading with it. And I reckon it's been a bit of a game changer for me being right amongst it, because I can hear what they're saying. I can see what they're struggling with in terms of pitches that they're seeing when they're defending. And then we can unpack some of that stuff on the field. If it's an easy fix, it might be just remember, stay square, come up, go hard and square, keep an eye on the ball, but have a little bit of a look at what's in front of you, keeping it in simple terms. but it also might be something that they're struggling with that's even deeper than that, and I just have to remember to review that and sit down with them the following day. So I think one of your questions was around was going to be around coaching defence, especially in a club environment, yeah, because you have limited time. Well, in a professional environment, we only train 2 days a week, really. Like on a Monday, we come in, we do a review, the boys have a little bit of a gym session, we have some new stuff, we get on the field, we walk through that. Most of that's walking or jogging, and then they play some games. You know, and that's Monday. So it's not really, it's learning focus. And then Tuesday, Thursday, they're only 90-minute sessions max. And a lot of times Thursday's only 65, 70. So we've got the same amount of time that a club coach has got. The luxury is we have time away from the training field to do the learning stuff. But that's our only real difference. So, and again, quite often you have a little bit more time at club level, because if you go 10 minutes longer at the end because you need to capture some learning, you can do that, whereas we're kind of having strung on injury management stuff, so guys not getting hurt because they've run too far, which is a story for another day. But anyway, it's important in the grand scheme of things in the long-term part of the season, but I struggle with that particular moment, but it's all good. But yeah, mate, I guess what I'm saying is there's not that much difference, and we can definitely do it, you know. So, and then you just need to go back and look at how much time are you spending on what, and what are you getting your return on investment from? Is if you're spending all your time learning some attack maps which don't actually work when you get into the game, or a couple of special plays or whatever, one of them might work and you might score one try from that, but you concede five because your defense is disorganized, then probably have to go back and look at how we allocate our time. But I guess the skill of all of it is that we're coaching attack and defense at the same time.
Yeah.
Which you can do if you've got 15 on 15.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Ronan. And we've sort of started doing that at our club too, is if the attack, we don't run attack drills against shadows, because shadows don't tackle. And it took the boys a good couple of weeks. I'd just be standing in the back line barking at them, you know, just get off the line, you know, but whatever our principles are. And they go, but it's an attack drill. I said, I don't care. If we get the ball, we attack them. And yeah, once that's switched, you get some good pay on it. So yeah, there's some good. So coaching the attack and defense at the same time is how we maximize our time. And it's just a good point that you made, that you guys don't get a lot more time on grass than we do. So, and as you know, mate, every coach will take every second of every minute that you give them, and there's never enough time.
Because we've all convinced ourselves that we're going to make the difference.
Yeah.
I'm still not convinced about that one, but anyway. I think when you look at that D stuff, is you have to scaffold some stuff away from it being 15 on 15 chaos, you know. So they need to learn some skills outside of that type of environment, which might be like isolating pitches that they see. So for example, for forwards, we often defend a pot of three off nine, right? So if we can get really good at that in terms of identifying cues, whatever our defensive system is, so for us it's just consistent spacing, get off the line, deal with anything on the inside of you, ball goes past you, connect on the outside, but stay high. So cool, pretty straightforward. But if we can see those pitches when we're building up our ability around defending, so I might need 50 of those before I feel real confident around getting off the line and being able to read what's going to happen. Is the middle guy got it? Is it going to the middle guy? Yes, that's obvious. Is the person out the back door live? Yes or no? Cool. Is the tip runner engaged on the ball? Yes or no? Is there potential of an inside pass? You know, or is that guy just going to catch and carry? Like, there's a few options that are happening in there, and we need to get used to those. And then when they are live, then we've got to be able to adapt to what's actually happening in front of us. But if we can do, you know, 50 of those for the first few weeks in preseason and really get comfortable with, man, we're just going to go up hard and just make a decision based on what's happening, then you've got, okay, guys who defend a short edge, which might be a winger, a midfielder, a centre, a halfback, maybe if you put your halfback there, they've got to get used to that picture, you know. So there might be four or five attackers, it'll be a winger, midfielder, probably a loose forward or a hooker, sometimes a fullback who comes and joins in different places. are they still going to have confidence of getting hard off the line and shutting them down? Like, what pitches don't they like and they feel like they're going to be a little bit more vulnerable so they don't come up? Then you've got, okay, that's defender pot of three forwards off 10, so let's get used to what that looks like. It's different. It's going to take longer for the ball to get there, but they generally set up deeper. There's probably bigger spacings between players, probably a backdoor option live. So again, let's get really good at that. And then there's a long edge, which is even is more challenging to defend, but it takes longer for the ball to get there. So once we start like building all those things in there in terms of our D, well, that's virtually the only things that happen. And then there's unstructured attack, but in that we just need to find a lot. We need to get a line as quick as possible. And then there'll be a ruck, and then it'll be one of those things that happens, you know? So we build up our understanding around those, and then we can go into 15 and 15, and there should be no surprises. We know that this is what it's going to be. Short side attack will look a little bit like this, might look a little bit different, but probably this relatively the same. Pot off 9, pot off 10, and a long edge attack, which is hard to defend if they execute it well. But if we can line speed them, put their catch pass under pressure, the passes are really long, we might be on for an intercept or whatever, you know? So then when we go back to 15 on 15, all that's happening is it's chaotic, but those are the pitches that are unfolding all the time. So I guess we can't do one without the other. Like, you need to probably build it'll, yeah, it would be, I don't think I'm not a good enough coach to build the 15 on 15 without doing some stuff that's a little bit more, you know, repetition of pitches, but remembering that every situation is slightly different anyway, because the pass will be different from 9. It might be a little bit more loopy, which gives us more time to line speed them. It might be a really good pass. He might be running onto it. He might be stationary. He might be really close. He might be really wide. Like, there's heaps of permutations in there which change things for us slightly, which provide degrees of stress, I guess, is a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, and that's a really good point there about breaking it down, like working that pass off 9 defensively. What do we do? So if we don't go to 15 on 15, we might go 8v8 or something, but we can still set those pitches for the defense and the attack and not going, shit, I haven't got 15 on 15, I can't run that. Like, you know, can we run it as a 10v10 and take the wingers out of play, or, you know, we're just going to not have a ruck there, or whatever that situation is, but making it work for the players you've got and the resources that you got.
You can just play on like 2/3 of the field. So still play on a full 100-meter field, but rather than playing on a full width, which is 70 meters or whatever, just play on 40 meters of it. Mm. And you might limit it to a pot off 9, a long edge, and a short side attack. Yeah. So you've still got 3 different pitches that can happen within that, and people still got to make reads based on that stuff. But it's, then you can do it with 8-on-8 or 10-on-10, you know, and then if you have 12-on-12, okay, we can go a little bit wider. What does that mean? Or we can now play a pot off 10 as well. You can still achieve the same stuff and make it look as much like the game's going to look. So that's obviously the underlying principle, right? We shouldn't be doing anything that doesn't look like the game.
Mm.
Like, I've banned people from doing static passing because I don't ever see anybody doing any static passing on the field. Like, we've got to interact with our environment. So the environment is not static. There's movement, there's variability, there'll be some sort of pressure, and there'll be some sort of competition happening out there, which is maybe building pressure, but maybe not.
Yeah.
And so if we're not ticking those 4 boxes in terms of the activities that we're doing, like, as soon as you put all 4 of those things in, it'll all of a sudden start looking like the game.
Yeah.
And if it's not looking like the game, then you're probably going, this is... The players probably going, what are we doing this for? But they're just not courageous enough to ask the question.
Yeah, and I find with the static, especially the static pass drill, is I face you and you face me and I pass it like that. I've never, ever seen a player do that in a game. You know?
Well, mate, I've never seen a line of 4 guys standing still pass the ball to each other either. Yeah. And I very rarely see a line of 4 players who are standing flat on each other pass it to each other either when they're jogging or even running fast. Mm. And that doesn't happen because a defender's going to stop that. Like, one defender can stop that.
Yeah.
Now, so we still do passing waves, you know, like 4 guys pass it to each other, pop it to the guy, they run back. I know it's a bit of a primer exercise, but that we never have 4 players running that flat on each other. Like, someone's going to have to pick up another line because not all 4 people can get the ball because one defender could probably stop that from happening. So why are we running that? Like, that's illogical. Like, that's not a skill that we even need. Like in isolation, like a one pass flat to somebody is, but four people doing that doesn't make any sense.
I've never thought of it that way either. Because we run heaps of passing waves, like you said, as primers and stuff like that.
But what I guess you could do the same drill passing waves, but if you put one or two defenders in there, changes the whole dynamic. So then people having to hold their depth more, they've got to pick up a line based on the cues that the defenders are giving them. That's all stuff that we see in the game, right? People naturally will hold their depth if they know they need to buy the ball, the player with the ball in his hand, some time to be able to get the ball away and execute a draw and pass. They know if they get too flat on that, the ball's probably going to go behind them. So that's all you need to do, right? Is just put the pressure element in there. Then you've got movement, you've got variability, you've got pressure, and then you just make it into a game. So there's some sort of competition. So they're competing with each other. Like, I think about our warm ups, and we don't probably have any competition in our warm up. I don't really know why that is. Because as soon as you get out in the field, there's one big competition. There's lots of mini competitions happening. Everyone's competing with each other, So. Maybe we need to have a bit more competition in our warm-ups as well to try and get that, because that adds a bit of pressure, right? So we're going to be under some pressure when we get out there. Like, there's no doubt about that, because there's 15 other jokers who want to win,
Yeah, and that warm-up, I still haven't, there's plenty of time, and most people have seen it. The team looks red hot in the warm-up, and they go out and they play like crap. And then there's been other days you go, that was the worst warm-up I've seen, and the boys are on fire. So it's like, making those, like I said, making those little differences and thinking about, well, if we're doing this in our warm-up, is it setting us up to play, or is it just setting us up to look good before we go out and play?
I guess if there's no pressure. So if we're running against shadows in the warm-up, we're going to be in for a hell of a shock when we get out there and there's some people trying to tackle us. Because everything's off. As soon as you don't have defenders, like, your footwork's off, your alignment's off, the hand speed's off, all the skills that we actually need to execute in the game are all off, because people catch the ball running for 4 or 5 metres before they get the pass away. They might have to execute a pass in the game with just holding their feet or stopping and actually catching it stationary, because they know that if they can get this pass away, or they might have to change their line because they're going to get smashed, all those skills that we do probably without thinking. If we're not, we probably should be using them in the warm-up, I would have thought, because we should be priming those, not skills that we're not going to use.
Yeah.
But I don't know, mate.
No, and
sometimes it's good for coach anxiety for the warm up to go good, but it's irrelevant after about 2 minutes after the game started.
And it's like most conversations we've had, mate. Now I'm thinking about 1,000 different ways to try and make things different. So that's why we do these things, mate, to start those conversations and make people think. But yeah, even like coaches, like you said, does it look good for us, or does it look good for the players? And you're probably of the same era as me when I was playing. If you drop the ball at training, it was press ups and 100 meter sprints and all this stuff. Where now, I know you're the same as me. Like, let the boys make mistakes, because that's how we're going to learn in that chaos.
It's that same principle, eh? It has to look like the game. There's lots of errors in the game. I've never seen a game without any errors.
No.
There's normally around 30 to 40 a game. So our training should look like that, because we have to operate in that type of environment in the game. So,
yeah. And I think as young coaches, we get very whistle happy. As soon as something goes wrong, we blow the whistle. And the boys that I coach now, the crew that I coach with, I reckon a whistle blows at the end of that 2 or 3 minute block. And that's, hardly ever blows, because if you knock it on, what are you going to do? What are you doing on Saturday? Where before it was like, hits the ground, we blow it up. So, again, making it look like what we're going to do on a game day. So, and being comfortable, and I think as a young coach, and you know, like when I started out, it was like everything's got to look good, and we got to win these games because that's where my next job's going to come from. But you know, that's not necessarily the case anymore.
I think around that point is people ask me that quite a bit, and I reckon it's two things. One, you got to build a really strong network, and the best way of doing that is by putting yourself into learning environments. You know, so getting on courses with people, or some stuff that we've done, or whatever. There's a million things that you can do. The only good thing that came out of COVID was it brought the world a bit closer together in terms of use of technology. So that's a really good thing. So you build a network, and if you can do that through learning, you know, then you build a connection with somebody, they get a job, they get you on board, you know, like that's kind of how it works. Building a network, and then secondly, you've got to have some success. But success has different meanings for different environments, right? So for some environments, success is winning a championship because that's what they're about. For other environments, it's building a sustainable club that, you know, you've now got three teams rather than just one team. And that's really successful. That's probably more difficult to do than winning a championship. You know, for some other clubs, it might be, hey, we've just been promoted. We just want to be mid-table and competitive.
Yeah.
You know, so you'd probably go about you know, your season plan differently if that's the goal, rather than the goal being, oh, we want to win the championship. You know, it might be more around developing players and building a squad so that when things start getting a bit tougher later on, you've actually got 30 players to call on rather than playing the best 23 every week or whatever, you know. So
yeah,
I think there's that relative success thing, but if we believe in what we say is our vision, then we have to communicate it. And that's the thing that always gets missed is we forget to communicate that. So then other people don't perceive us being successful because they don't know actually what we're trying to achieve, you know, which might be we want to have three teams, or you know, we want to win the second division to get promoted in the first division and then survive up there. But we want to do it this way without just going and buying in a whole bunch of guys to try and survive, because then we know we're going to alienate everybody else and all that hard work we've done is going to be down the tubes, you know. So
yeah. So what does success look like to you and the club? Yeah.
Well, it has to be aligned, because if it's not.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that forms your recruitment strategy of your coach, right? Is the club saying, this is our vision, success for us is this. The coach says, oh, no, I want to win a championship. That's my only measure of success. Well, that's not a meeting of mine. So perhaps that coach should be at another club where that is what they want to do, you know. Or, but also that coach might have that ambition, but he knows, oh, well, maybe step three is that we can actually win the championship, but that's just now the club vision right now, which is to build three teams, and then we can worry about some of that stuff later on and maybe be a bit more ambitious.
Yeah, no, and that's a good point, mate, making sure we all align, because there's plenty of coaches, we all know them, that's what they want to do, they want to win that championship, and then others are like, I want my players to improve. And if we're not on board, if we're not all on board, we're getting nowhere, really, like you said. That's really good, mate. Thanks. And what about feedback for your players? I know you spoke there, but when you're running those 15 on 15s, there's those little conversations, you know, those little one-on-one chats and just keywords to players that are doing that. But the bigger picture, feedback stuff, potentially around a player's performance, you know, the courageous conversations or the difficult conversations. Have you got any advice on the best way to go ahead with them? Because, mate, they're called difficult conversations for a reason, and a lot of coaches struggle with them.
I think I'd be lying if I said I don't struggle with them. And I think the reason is I actually care about the people.
Yep.
And I know especially for a lot of young rugby players, their identity is so caught up in rugby that actually getting some constructive feedback or not being selected is always the one that really gnaws away at their identity, which is when they're probably not equipped with the skills to deal with that, right? So we have to manage that because that's not what it should be. Like, it should just be, hey, mate, you're not on the team this week. These are the things we've already agreed on that you need to improve at. It's not quite happening yet. Somebody else deserves an opportunity, or they came off the bench and played really well. So, and they did these things. You know, that's pretty evidence-based, and it's, we're still in a partnership. We still want to get better at these things. But the reality is it's not that easy, because we're dealing with people, and for some of them, they take it really hard. And, you know, that does make it hard, definitely. And it still gives me anxiety. Always feel like it's too rushed as well, which is something that I need to work on, because it's always, you know, oh, yeah, hey, can we have a catch-up tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. And it's always, maybe an hour before the selection meeting, and then you've got to get through five or six chats, and it's always like, oh, man, I've still got two more people to see. And but anyway, I think a couple of key things that always help me is, one, if you care about them, it should be easier, and the feedback should come from a place of care rather than a place of frustration. So if it's coming from a place of frustration, just don't do it. Second thing is, we have to ask for permission. So, are you okay with me giving you some feedback right now? How do you like, you know, when we frame it up at the beginning of the season, how do you like feedback delivered? Like, some guys will say to me, hey, Mike, if you're going to give me some feedback, I prefer, if you can, send me some evidence. You know, so it might be a couple of clips or whatever. Cool, and then they'll have some time to process that. They can come in, and we can just have a cordial or a chat about it. And for other guys, they would just rather, oh, no, just tell me straight. That's cool. I can just tell you straight. And then there's like heaps of people who like to have it in different ways as well, you know. But I guess if we've got a good enough relationship, it should hurt less, but it still definitely hurts them.
Mm-hmm.
But so definitely asking for permission, figuring out what type of feedback that they like. And then just, you can't, I've made this mistake so many times, you just can't sugarcoat it. So we need it. There's a reason why they're not on the team. We need to tell them. We need to agree on how we're going to get better at that, and we need to work on it together and then move forward. If we just bullshit them and be like, oh, no, you're going well, mate, just keep doing what you're doing, we miss the opportunity then to work with them on the thing that they really need to improve on. And then they end up just getting frustrated and probably doing a whole bunch of damage to our environment if they're frustrated. So,
yeah.
One really good thing as well that I haven't done yet, but I was told about recently, is after providing those feedback meetings, get the players to, they can choose who they feed it back to. So they can either feed it back to me again. So just to make sure that they've had understanding of what the conversation was, they can feed it back to another player. So it might be one of the leaders or one of the other coaches, which I haven't started doing, which I think that just makes so much sense. Because sometimes I wonder whether what I'm like, because it's an emotional situation, like, they're unhappy that they're not on the team. Are they actually listening? Have we actually agreed on some stuff? Or has the whole thing, that whole conversation, just been in one ear out the other because they're in the red? Which I know for some guys it is. I can see it. Like, they just can't wait to get out of there. I could be saying anything and then they're not listening. So I reckon that's a real helpful tool, actually. And if they don't feel comfortable sharing it back to me, it might be to one of the, you know, it might be to the captain or leadership player, and then he comes and sits down. Hey, man, this doesn't seem right to me. Was this your recollection of that conversation? Okay, cool. What's the agreed steps from here? Might be the captain to sit down with him and go, oh, man, I think you need to go and have a chat with Mike, because I don't think that's what he was saying. I don't think he was saying that you're an arsehole. I think he was just saying that we need to improve your connection on defense, you know?
Yeah. And that's really good, getting that clarification too, because I know this year I made an error in putting on a player that I shouldn't have put on, and we took him off sort of straight away. And he was rightly dirty on me. And he was talking to our captain, and the captain went, go and talk to him and find. And as soon as he spoke to him, I said, mate, I stuffed this up. There's nothing, this is all on me. I stuffed this up. And explain what had happened. It was just one of those times in the game where everything was happening and the comms was going off and blah, blah, blah. And he walked away and went, oh, okay, cool. I said, mate, you can still be angry at me. Be angry at me all you like. But when I broke it down and explained it, he went, oh, okay, cool. And he was happy. And he went off and did what he, you know, instead of just walking away that potentially being toxic at the next session. And but getting that clarification on around why things are happening.
Yeah, man, I think it's really important. It's definitely something I improve on.
Yeah.
Like the whole feedback, constructive conversations, that stuff. It's mate, it's hard.
Oh, absolutely, they're hard, mate. And I think my players know that I hate having them too. I hate having to give those conversations as well. So, you know, it doesn't make it any easier on them, but they know I don't like doing it either. So,
yeah, and I think one thing I've been reflecting on a bit lately is there's a couple of guys I coached last season who didn't really get any better. And if I think about the feedback conversations, one of them was, oh, no, that's all good. I understand. The meeting was over in 30 seconds. Like, he was not selected most weeks. But I actually let that slide because I was just happy for the conversation to be over. Mm-hmm. But at no stage did we actually agree on our next steps, what we're working on together, how he was going to demonstrate that he was ready, all that stuff. So it was just like tokenism, basically. And another one of the players, there was a lot of interference, is probably a good way of thinking about it. And because of that, we didn't have real clarity on what the plan was.
Yeah.
Because there was lots happening, you know, in his life, and, you know, which is understandable, but I still kind of had to bring it back to, hey, man, you're a rugby player. We want you to improve your rugby. We want you to be playing. How are we going to do this? Yeah, we need to sort out some of those peripheral things, but we actually need to have some tangible stuff that we can do together during the week. And I look back now and go, well, neither of those guys got any better.
Yeah.
And so I probably failed them a bit because I was just happy with the comfort of the conversation as opposed to the, hey, let's bring this back to what we said we were going to do in terms of this is going to be a partnership. So,
yeah. And again, you know, you can relate that back to that. Oh, that drill looked really nice and crisp, so it looks good, so we can move on.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, absolutely, mate. That's a good reflection. Yeah, now I'm going to have to think about some of the stuff I've said to players over the last couple of years. Yeah, that's a good reflection, mate. Do you just want to give us a bit of a story around the Inside Running Academy and what is offer, what around that process? So if any of the listeners are keen to get their kids involved, they know what to expect.
Nothing like a little bit of self-promotion, eh? How good.
Right. That's what we do it for.
So Inside Running Academy is a private rugby academy that I operate here in Mount Maunganui, New Zealand. We established in 2010. You know, we had really successful business. Then COVID forced us to shut down entirely. Back up and running full-time from last week. Today we actually had 99 players in, which is a bit of a record for us. And 11 coaches as well who are doing a coaches course at the same time, which has been really awesome. But in effect, we offer programs in duration from anything from 2 weeks up to 20 weeks. Players aged 14 and over. Generally, the players are aged 18 plus, come for longer term stuff, which is cool. Might be in a gap year or transitioning from high school to pub rugby, or they missed an academy contract somewhere, so they want to come here and try and have a second chance. And I've even got a couple of girls who are, I won't say they're older because it's going to offend them. They are more experienced, and they've come in because they really want to have a crack at playing professionally after being out of the game for a while. And now there's all these professional opportunities for females, which is awesome. So they've come in to like get re-established their rugby again, which is a great idea. So people want to get in touch. Well, that easiest place to go is our website, which is rugbyacademy.global. I jump on there, all the information about our camps and stuff is on there. So pretty much run from now until the end of August, all sorts of different stuff happening. And it's effectively living the life of a professional rugby player without the pressure of having to play on a Saturday in front of people that are baying for your blood if you don't win. So it's the best of both worlds.
Yeah, no, that's good, mate. And I'll put the links to that in the show notes so that anyone wants to reach out, they can reach out to you. Just a couple more, mate, and I'll let you go. Coach development wise, what do you do? What do you encourage other coaches to do around the development space? Not because we've all got the coach education side where we go and do the, you know, level 1, 2, 3, 4. But we should be developing ourselves as coaches. So what do you do and what would you suggest to other coaches?
I do lots, and it's a little bit of an obsession of mine, so I don't expect people to do what I do. So stuff that I do is I have a couple of mentors that I connect with regularly. My main mentor is a guy called Jay Carter, who actually runs a podcast called Talking Performance. Mm-hmm. He's New Zealand's national golf coach. I've worked with him since 2016, I think, or 2017. Awesome guy. We built a really good friendship. And he keeps me pretty level in terms of, I guess, pushing me back towards my identity, my who I am as a person and as a coach. I think that's really valuable. The second thing I do is I run a couple of online coaching courses that are very selfishly for my development just as much as the other people. So if I've got an area of interest, I run a course on it. People come on. I have guest presenters come on and I get to do learning. And the best thing about that is I get to ask them whatever questions that I want because I facilitate the conversation. So that's a real big one for me. I practice a lot. So the value of having Insta Running Academy up and running again is I've got 100 odd rugby players here at the moment. I delivered some stuff this morning that I've never delivered before. I'll deliver some stuff tomorrow that I've never done before. I saw a couple of games that other coaches ran today that I've never seen before that I'm going to steal. But I think that's a really key thing is let's say you're coaching, you know, the top club in Melbourne and you're like, you know, involved with the Rebels or whatever, and you're really on this pathway of wanting to explore professional rugby, you need to go and coach another team or get into other environments where you can just practice. I think everybody needs to do this. We just need to go somewhere else where we can actually work with a group of players and there's no performance, anxiety, pressure type stuff, because I think as soon as we're coaching in a team, we've got limited grass time, we're worried about whether we win or lose on Saturday. Typically, all we do is coach what we know and we don't take a lot of risks. Now, if we apply that same theory to players, we're asking them to fail a lot at training. We want it to be messy. We want it to be chaotic. The same principle has to apply to coaches because otherwise we're not getting better. So we're just doing the same shit that we've done because we're comfortable and confident with it. So I think that out there practicing stuff is really important. And then I'm like mad keen networker and sharer. So always kind of challenged. So whether that's networking with people, listening to podcasts, doing a whole bunch of that stuff, or just having the courage to reach out to somebody that I know has got something that I'm interested in. So as an example, when Anthony Seibold was with England, I don't know the guy, he's on a coaching group that I'm on, but I've never had an interaction with him before. I grabbed his number, sent him a WhatsApp message, hey mate, defense coach, blah, blah, blah. And I'm really interested in rugby league's influence on rugby union defending at the moment. And there's a lot of rugby league coaches that are popping up in different teams. And I've started doing some work on tackle selection and in particular trying to use catch tackling, which is a league thing in rugby union. Anyway, got back to me, spent an hour with him on a Zoom, challenged me in a whole bunch of ways that weren't defense related. I picked up a couple of gold nuggets in terms of the D. He said to me, oh, you can come into any of my environments, which I will take him up on because I supported Manly as a young fella growing up. So it'd be pretty cool to get along to Brookvale. And I will take him up on that. But he told me to go and do some things around my own development before he would facilitate that for me, which is really cool, right? So having the courage to actually do that. And at the end of the day, I've asked another coach about something totally different. Again, I don't know the guy and I didn't get a reply, but I'm not offended by that. Like, he's busy. He's coaching his team. He's within his rights. He probably gets shitloads of people contact him. So he didn't reply and that's all good. So I think just having the courage to actually get out there and ask some people. Like, so I said, I do quite a bit around it. And sometimes I wonder whether it's actually making me better. I think it is, but I'm not sure. And a coach shared something with me the other day which I thought was really good for me in terms of how my brain works. So he drew up a box a presentation. So he drew up a box on the screen and he said, inside the box is stuff that we do that we know we do really well, you know. Outside the box is stuff that we're really curious about or interested in. And in order to take something from out there and put it inside the box to something we're going to do in our day-to-day practice within our teams. We've got to research it. We've got to connect with people who know a lot about it. We've got to test it ourselves. So we've got to apply it in maybe in a different environment. So we need to go through this process, and then it goes in, and then we can start using it. Now, that's great for me because I have a million ideas that sit outside the box.
Yeah.
So they're not things I'm currently using. So that's how he challenged me around that rugby league stuff. He was like, oh, that's a good idea, but mate, you need to go and talk to somebody who knows how to do this.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, well, how about I talk to a rugby league coach who's actually now coaching rugby and was now gone to, back to rugby league. But that was the most perfect guy that I thought that I could get in touch with about it, and that's what ended up happening. So, and now I'm confident about integrating it into our team because I've actually been through that process. So I think coach development's awesome if you're really curious and stuff, but we still need to bring things back to, hey man, what are we going to do in our team? Which is, you know, the players will think you're mad if you're just turning up every week with two new ideas and no follow through on the ideas that you had last week. And we're probably all being coached by people like that. And I don't think that's very helpful. Players aren't going to get any better if you're doing that. So it's probably less helpful than just doing what you already know.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, mate. All the stuff that we learn, we just put in little cabinets and we just pull it out when we need it. Yeah, I like it. Mate, last one, I'll let you go. If you could go back in time to that 2010 Mike Rogers, what advice would you give yourself knowing what you know now around coaching?
That's a good question because I ask this question of all the coaches that I kind of interview on the Coach Leading series, but my answer is a bit different, and I've changed my answer recently and thinking about it more. I don't think I'd say anything. And the reason I'd love to say so many things, but I'd hold myself back because I think the journey is what makes us the coaches that we've become, and we have to fail heaps. We have to do heaps of shit that's not very good. We have to go through some really tough times when we're thinking about quitting, to learn some resilience and perseverance. We have to learn this, like all those learnings that have happened. There's going to be so many more like over the next 10 or 20 years, however long I keep coaching for. It would be really nice to be able to speed up the hurt period. And it's still like, I still do things all the time where I'm like, why did you do that? You're such an idiot.
Mm.
But they just become all that happens is they become a little bit less consequential or catastrophic.
Yeah.
You know, so, but you still make mistakes all the time. And then you're like reflecting on that. Oh man, I was a bit slack there or whatever. But those early ones, it would be nice to, rather than it taking me 6 or 7, 8 years to make 3 or 4 monumental fuck-ups, it would have been nice to do that all in a year. And then I could have got on with actually improving my practice.
Yeah.
But that's not the world that we live in, right? Because probably need to make a mistake, reflect on it, get better, convince yourself that you've got all the answers. A couple of years later, make another one because you've got ahead of yourself a little bit, and then it probably just follows that same thing. And now, like, I make heaps of mistakes all the time. Don't think I'm an expert on anything. Love learning. I know that I'm going to make some mistakes in the next season at the Free Jacks. Hopefully they're not too consequential or catastrophic, but they're just another opportunity to learn. So I would love to say like 100 things to that person, but I'd actually think that would be doing the learning opportunity a little bit of a disservice.
And
he wasn't a good listener either, so it probably wouldn't have made any difference.
It wouldn't have made any difference, mate. That's a pretty in-depth reflection on that, mate. And I've never thought of it that way, you know. Like, you've got to go through that tough time to the learnings. Mate, this has been awesome. As you know, I could talk to you for hours on rugby stuff, but I'll let you go and prep for your sessions tomorrow. Mate, been great talking to you. Good luck with the Free Jacks, and we'll definitely stay in touch.
Yeah, thanks very much, Bully. Really appreciate your time. And, mate, real credit to you. Like, the work that you do is what keeps this machine, keeps the wheel turning in terms of our coaches developing. And I think, we need more people out there, doing the stuff that you do. It's might be listening to a podcast or getting to meet you and connecting with you that keeps that person who's sitting on the fence whether they're going to come back next year and give it another crack. And so being able to connect with our community coaches for them to understand how important they are in people's lives, that they need to persevere, it is hard, But just understanding that it's a forever thing. And the cool thing is it's really rewarding, which we didn't even talk about today. But there's so many good things that come out of our awesome game. And so, yeah, full credit to you and love your work.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate your time. And as I said, mate, we could talk for hours. Now I've got a heap of things I need to go and think about myself now. So.
Me too, because I think I've probably just talked way too much shit and I'm going to have to try and figure out what I actually said.
Nah, it's all good, mate. Mate, thanks for your time.
That's a mighty shot. A mighty Mark Lesnar have driven them off their own ball. That is monstrous.
Being held at the back by the foot of Ben Moore, Captain in England, marching it on. Will they get a penalty? Still there. There's the penalty.
Tom, I think that's drama you ever seen. All the way to the try line. That was extraordinary. 30 metres.